Well, good afternoon, listeners. This is the Dogs Program, the Australian Council for Defence of Government Schools, and we're here every Saturday at 12 on the dot. What do we stand for? We stand for public education. That's education that is public in every sense of the term, public in ownership and control. It's public in purpose, but above all, it's public in access. No child, no teacher, no parent, no cleaner, no employee can be sent away because they are the wrong religion or the wrong colour or the wrong sexual preference or whatever. It's open to all. And we want to keep it that way because that's the only sort of education system that is fine for a democracy. And although we think that private schools should exist if they want to, we think they should pay for themselves because we also believe in separation of religion from the state. We don't believe that any religion should get one penny from the state. It's a matter of conscience, it's a matter of the family, and it's a private matter. But unfortunately, back in the 1990s, Mr. Howard thought that the children in our public schools weren't getting enough Christianity of his sort. Far be it from me to say that Mr. Howard was a Christian, but so he imposed a system of ministers in our public schools, chaplains. And the separationists like ourselves and the rationalists and the humanists have been trying to get rid of them ever since because they replaced the secular people who were well qualified, who had to have 6 years of teaching and then quite a few years of psychological and other training before they were allowed loose on our children. And yet here, Mr. Howard was prepared to allow people who had a few months religion into our schools. Not good enough. But over in Western Australia, there's been a bit of a win. And here's press release 1050. And here's Andy going to tell us what's been happening over in Western Australia.
Thanks, Jane. And this is the Australian Council for the Defence of Government Schools press release number 1050. Secular advocates back WA public school community's call for secular wellbeing officers and rejection of outsourcing. And this was written by Cy Gladman and published in The Rationalist on the 29th of August. Advocates for secular public education are stepping up the pressure on the West Australian government to put an end to the funding of religious chaplains in public schools after school communities made their voices clear on the issue. Last weekend, delegates attending the annual conference of the peak body representing parents and carers of public school students, the Western Australian Council of State School Organisations, WACSO, voted in support of every public school being able to directly employ secular wellbeing officers. The Rationalist Society of Australia understands that there was strong support and no amendments to the motion presented to the conference. The motion, as reported by the RSA last week, asked for WACSO to advocate for every public school to have state government employed and funded wellbeing positions that are permanent, secular, professional, with direct employment by schools. The preamble to the motion argued that the outsourcing arrangements were no longer fit for purpose, with staff in these roles reporting low wages, unpaid holidays, and insecure employment. The public school communities of Western Australia have been leading the push to end religious-based discrimination in the chaplaincy roles funded by both the state government and the federal government under the National Student Wellbeing Program, NSWP. Where public schools seek to appoint chaplains, they have to use third-party providers, primarily Christian organisations such as Youth Care and Scripture Union, that require applicants to have religious credentials. In 2022, delegates at the WACSO conference also unanimously supported a similar motion that called for WACSO to advocate for clinical student social and emotional wellbeing programs that would employ qualified people with appropriate expertise and would do so without bias or discrimination. Secular advocacy group WA Public School Alliance is now urging the state's education minister, Sabine Winton, to listen to parents and carers and give all public schools the choice to directly hire student wellbeing officers. The group has written to Minister Winton this week following the result at the WACSO conference. The RSA understands that non-government schools in receipt of funding under the NSWP have the choice to directly hire secular student wellbeing officers, while public schools are forced to use third-party providers. Allowing schools to directly employ wellbeing officers through the state's Department of Education would mean the removal of religious-based criteria previously described by the state's Equal Opportunity Commission as constituting prima facie religious conviction discrimination under state laws. Earlier this year, the RSA reported that the Cook government had begun a trial allowing one public school, Anzac Terrace Primary School, the ability to directly employ a person for the role without having to source a chaplain or wellbeing officer via third-party labour hire firms. However, the government has not yet provided information about whether the one-year pilot program would be expanded and whether the secular wellbeing officer would continue to be directly employed. The RSA understands that South Australia, Victoria and Northern Territory provide flexibility for public schools, allowing them to use NSWP funds to either directly employ or outsource. As reported by the RSA in 2023, the Australian Capital Territory does not allow public schools to hire chaplains. And back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you very much, Andy. And it's been quite an exciting time for teachers in Victoria who are up and fighting, particularly those who are dealing with children, small children, the kindergarten teachers and the educators. They are not happy. They shouldn't be happy either. And there's the question of industrial action. Back to Andy.
Thanks, Jean. 15 months of negotiations and no pay offer. Victorian kindergarten teachers and educators start industrial action. Teachers and educators at hundreds of Victorian kindergartens started industrial action on the 25th of August, demanding the Allan Labor government invest in decent pay and conditions. The Australian Education Union Victorian branch's recent State of Our Kinders survey of 1,182 Victorian kindergarten teachers and educators shows almost half, 48%, always or often think about leaving the early childhood profession. Low pay and excessive workload, including compliance and administration and insufficient planning time, are key issues that kindergarten staff outline as reasons for considering leaving their profession. The top three issues driving this are excessive requirements related to compliance and monitoring, insufficient planning time, and poor opportunities to progress salaries. Kindergarten teachers report that they are working almost 6.6 hours unpaid overtime each week, which is equivalent to around one day a week of free labour. After 15 months of bargaining, the Allan government has not offered teachers and educators a pay increase at all. This is deeply disrespectful and shows the government's lack of respect for early childhood staff. Kindergarten teachers and educators are seeking a 35% pay increase to make sure salary is competitive with school staff and improved conditions that address excessive workloads and burdensome administrative requirements. The first phase of industrial action includes stopping work to coincide with a visit to a kindergarten by a Victorian Member of Parliament from the Australian Labor Party, not responding to any inquiries from or on behalf of employers other than those related to OHS, child safety and welfare, or related to the teacher or educator's working conditions, not attending staff meetings called by employers. Teachers and educators are also planning a 24-hour stop work action later in Term 3. Comments attributable to AEU Victorian Branch President Justin Mullaly: kindergarten teachers and educators need to be valued and recognised for the important work they do. But right now, the Allan Labor government is not showing them the respect they deserve. In fact, they are doing the opposite. You can't call Victoria the education state when nearly half of our kinder teachers and educators are ready to leave the profession, feeling abandoned by the state government. Early learning is vital for children. It supports their cognitive, social, physical, and language development. We get the best outcomes for children through quality early learning, and quality comes from supporting and investing in the workforce. Teacher and educator pay has fallen significantly behind education industry standards and will not be competitive with primary school teacher pay, meaning teachers will not be attracted to work in early childhood education. Our kindergarten teachers and educators are struggling with unsustainably high workloads, huge administrative burdens, and a lack of support to help children get the additional support they need. These challenges are driving teachers and educators out of the early childhood profession at a time when we need more than 11,000 teachers and educators to realise the vision of fee-free kinder for all Victorian 3- and 4-year-olds. The Allan Labor government must take these challenges seriously and support and invest in our kindergarten teachers and educators. Key facts: Victorian kinder teachers and educators have been in bargaining for more than 15 months. The Allan government has not offered any pay increase at all. The state government is the funder of Victoria's kindergarten programs. The industrial action will include teachers and educators in community-based kindergartens governed by Victorian Early Childhood Teachers and Educators Agreement across the state. And good luck to them. I hope they get a win. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you very much, Andy, but let's have a quick break, shall we?
Well, brothers and sisters, what a show of strength we've got here today.
Local issues.
So I'm here at the School Kids Strike for Climate Action.
Live coverage.
Join the spirit of this gathering here today at IMARC.
Your voices.
So give us a bit of a lowdown about what's happening.
There's about 250 people here at the moment.
Community struggles.
We're now in front of the Tundaminawaya Morbohina Monument. I'd like to thank Community Radio 3CR, who for the last decade has been broadcasting here.
Feed Radical Radio, your membership is vital.
A few hundred people about to pass us right now. Lots of young people standing up for their future.
Subscribe today.
Go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe or call the station on 9419 8377.
Panoply, panorama, panpipe, pansy, aha, pansexual, knowing no boundaries of sex or gender. Sound interesting? Then join Sally on Sundays at noon for Out of the Pan. All those gender questions making you think too hard? Whether it's transgender, bisexual, polyamorous or beyond, we'll throw those questions into the pan and cook up the answers for you. So go on, push that gender envelope. Only on 3CR 855am digital and 3cr.org.au. Let's cook.
Well, we hope you're still listening to the Dogs program, because we've got a very interesting program, particularly what's coming up next. Those of us who can remember the times when teachers had to lose their job when they got married will be very pleased to find that up there in New South Wales, they're still fighting. And they had a New South Wales Teachers Federation Women's Conference. It was the women who came, who were educated in the 1930s, whose men didn't come home from the war, the teachers of that generation who fought the equal pay battle in New South Wales. And they were great people too. But the next generation had to fight the battle to allow married women to be in the classroom, and that was a battle that was worth fighting. And then, of course, there's the question of promotion. Anne Summers, Dr. Anne Summers, has written quite a lot for the feminist movement, and she had something to say at this New South Wales Teachers Federation Women's Conference last week. Let's hear about it, shall we, from Sorrel.
Thanks, Jean. This article is entitled Continue Fighting to Protect and Advance Women's Rights. Dr. Anne Summers urges New South Wales Teachers Federation Women's Conference. Women's lives have significantly changed since the 1970s, but they haven't changed enough. Feminist activist Dr. Anne Summers told delegates at Federation's Women's Conference on the 23rd of August. This year's conference celebrated 50 years of Federation's women's program, and the 50th anniversary since the publication of Dr. Summers' book, Damned Whores and God's Police. Reflecting on this year's theme, 50 Years of Fierce, Dr. Summers began by discussing the treatment of women at the beginning of her feminist career. It seems almost unbelievable today, but until the late 1970s, it was perfectly legal for women to be treated as inferiors, she told the audience, recounting how jobs were once classified by gender and routinely excluded women. Things changed, big and small. A small example, the signs on the toilet doors in federal parliament had to be repainted to signify women or men instead of senators or members. Today, Dr. Summers is a professor of domestic and family violence at the University of Technology of Sydney. Her work uncovers the hidden economic, financial, and emotional costs faced by women who have experienced domestic violence. Women who have experienced domestic violence face an unemployment gap of 5.3% compared to women who have never experienced partner abuse, according to her research. Highlighting the ongoing marginalisation, discrimination and abuse faced by women, Dr. Summers calls for feminist activists to practice vigilance and continue fighting to protect and advance women's rights. Delegates were exceptionally inspired and moved by the speech, giving her a standing ovation. Dr. Summers' speech was just phenomenal. It's really given me more depth and more insight and, of course, fierceness and more drive to really look into women's positions in the workplace, in society, in the world, Johanna Giraud of Forbes North Public School said afterwards. Our teacher activists reflect further on 50 Years of Fierce during a panel chaired by Gail Shelston. Consisting of Siobhan Callan, Darrell Duncan, Joan Lemaire, Michelle Rosicki, and Charlene Emzin Boyd, a second panel focused on the future of teaching and women's roles in the profession. This panel, chaired by Katinka Kastner, consisted of Azka Afzal, Simrit Atwal, Trang Dao, Jesse Ether, and Alice Leung. Delegates were given the opportunity to attend a range of workshops, which included using Department of Education resources to support LGBTQIA+ community members in school settings, organizing for complex need and equity, supporting schools to address complex student behavior, including sexual harassment, leading and controlling your personal development plan. You've been asked to attend a meeting with an executive teacher principal. What next? You too can be president of your association. More about those invisible women. Strong women, strong voices. Learning from Black activism. Suspension and expulsion implementation procedures. Assisting executive teachers to lead difficult conversations with staff. All about my membership. Connecting with colleagues to increase awareness of member benefits. TAFE women. Knowing your rights and rebuilding TAFE. The conference was a big success, with members able to share knowledge and experience with other women. Members left feeling empowered and confident to shape the future. Back over to you, Jean.
Yes, well, thank you very much, Sorrel, for that. And thanks to Dr. Anne Summers as well and the New South Wales Teachers Federation. But all around Australia, all the schools, public and private, are in trouble because teachers are leaving the profession. Why? Here is Andy to talk about it.
Thanks, Jean. It's not about money. Why teachers are leaving their profession. And this was published in The Educator on the 1st of September and written by Brett Henneberry. In recent years, Australian schools have experienced a teacher shortage not seen since the 1970s. And it's an issue that's becoming more widespread as mounting workloads and worsening levels of stress plague the profession. According to recent data from the Australian Institute for Teaching and School Leadership, up to 30% of teachers are considering leaving the profession before retirement age, and this comes at a time when student numbers are soaring and academic outcomes are slipping. On the 15th of December 2022, federal, state and territory education ministers agreed on a National Teacher Workforce Action Plan aimed at improving teacher supply, retaining teachers, revamping initial teacher education, elevating the profession and better understanding future teacher workforce needs. However, 3 years on, research shows that the stressors that are leading teachers to quit the profession are only worsening. A new study by UNSW Sydney found more than two-thirds of teachers describe their workload as largely or completely unmanageable, with a staggering 90% reporting severe stress. Professor Martin Mills has been an activist, a marathon runner, a teacher, an academic, and a shaper of policy. He's now on a mission to address Australia's teacher shortage crisis, and it's not a problem only money can fix. A research professor in the QUT School of Education in the Faculty of Creative Industries, Education and Social Justice, Professor Mills believes the answer lies in treating the teaching profession with greater respect, as well as providing new teachers with better support, including mentors. Teachers want professional autonomy. Professor Mills said when teachers were asked what they need to stay in the job, more money, while important, is rarely the first answer. They want the freedom and time to be able to teach and to have their voices heard by the education system, Professor Mills told The Educator. When teachers talk about the joys of teaching, they speak of the ways they have come up with practices and curricula that have caused excitement and engagement amongst their students. Professor Mills said this shows that teachers are looking for the professional autonomy to make decisions that will engage their students. Many of the teachers we speak to through our different projects feel their voices have been ignored when it comes to educational reforms, that they are overwhelmed with administrative tasks that have little to do with their students' learning, and that consequently much of the joy has been sucked out of teaching in the current moment. Surveillance and control eroding teachers' trust. Professor Mills said teachers have become increasingly frustrated by the hyper-focus on standardised tests, which they feel is diluting the impact of their core job. They don't want to feel like they are part of a sausage factory, Professor Mills said. While tracking and assessing how young people in classes are progressing is a necessary component of teaching, standardised tests have become the marker of this progression and have been used to evaluate both schools, or more accurately, principals and teachers. Professor Mills said the reliance on standardised testing has reshaped school leadership in ways that are adding pressure on teachers. As a consequence of the evaluative impact of these tests on the quality of leadership within a school, many teachers feel that schools have put stress onto them through heightened surveillance and control, often through mandating practices that have been deemed as universally applicable to all students in all places from all backgrounds, he said. Furthermore, many teachers feel that these tests do not capture what it is that they do in the classroom. Ignored are the ways in which they have helped their students to develop inquisitiveness, to grow emotionally and socially, to think about their world, and how to make it a better place for all to live in. Teaching deserves the same respect as law, medicine, and engineering. Professor Mills said society must respect the profession and recognise that teaching is the equivalent of any other profession and looked up to as much as an engineer, a lawyer, or a doctor. A significant part of teaching entails intellectual work and needs to be recognised as such, he said. It requires deep subject knowledge, but that alone is not sufficient. Teachers also need to understand the contexts and backgrounds from which the people in their classrooms come from, and they need to consider the appropriate pedagogical approaches to take with both the curriculum and the students in mind. Alongside this intellectual work, significant emotional demands, what some refer to as emotional labour, are placed on teachers, Professor Mills noted. Many students, and especially those who need the most help, come from very marginalised backgrounds and difficult out-of-school lives, he said. For these students to succeed, teachers need to be able to build meaningful relationships with them. The complexity of this work requires significant professional judgments, as much as, if not more than, any other profession. Yes, indeed. Back to you, Jane.
That was all pretty meaty stuff, wasn't it? Let's have a break, shall we?
Looking for an easy way to keep up with your annual 3CR subscription? You can now set up an annual debit from your bank account or credit card, and once a year your payment will be automatically deducted. You can cancel at any time and you'll get a reminder each year before payment. Be a constant supporter of Melbourne's precious independent community radio station and set up a recurring payment today. Just go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio 855 AM. Visit the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au/podcast to hear the most recent recording from each show, or 3cr.org.au/streaming to listen live.
Well, we hope you're still listening to the Dogs program, because we're now going overseas with our international expert. Here is Jeff.
Good afternoon. Whilst we're suffering along with the issues that have been happening on the streets of Melbourne, the manosphere and what goes on in that has got some interest, as well as what the Naziosphere has been doing. I thought we'd have a look at this article from the National Secular Society president, I think she is, Megan Manson, from the 7th of April 2025. And this is about education and misogyny in education in England, especially religious misogyny. And it's, why aren't we taking religious misogyny seriously? Monday, 7th of April, 25, by Megan Manson. This appeared on secularism.org.uk. A popular Netflix show has politicians astir over young men being exposed to misogynistic ideology. But they have a blind spot when it comes to misogyny promoted by religious charities, says Megan Manson. Around the country, youths are regularly listening to charismatic and articulate lecturers who explain why men have authority over women. These lecturers are telling them that women should stay home and do the cooking and cleaning, that women should submit their husbands' commands, that women shouldn't meet anyone without their husband's permission. Impressionable boys and young men are being told that women and girls must dress a certain way so they don't inflame sexual desire in men, and that giving women equal rights has corrupted society. Worst of all, these youths are being told husbands have a right to sex on demand and that it's acceptable to beat a woman who refuses. I'm not talking about videos by Andrew Tate and other misogynistic influencers on TikTok. I'm talking about lectures given by religious leaders in places of worship. The Netflix drama Adolescence has thrown a spotlight on the radicalisation of boys and young men into incel ideology. Incel, which stands for involuntary celibate, refers to men who blame all their problems on women, particularly their inability to find a romantic or sexual partner. It's increasingly used as a catch-all term for the modern-day misogynist. Adolescence, which tells the story of a teenage boy accused of murdering a girl in his class, is being taken extremely seriously by politicians. It's been referred to in several parliamentary debates, in the UK of course, on subjects ranging from relationships, education to rugby league. The Welsh Education Secretary pledged to speak to school pupils to learn more about concerns raised in adolescence. Prime Minister Keir Starmer called for adolescence to be shown in schools and even met the show's creators at Number 10 to hear their views, an invitation that most women's rights campaigners can only dream of. Adolescence is a beautifully made and powerful piece of film, but it is art nonetheless. It's a work of fiction created by the writers and filmmakers. But misogyny and violence against women and girls are very real, as are their cheerleaders, looking to recruit the next generation of male supremacists. However, where misogyny is promoted by religious groups, politicians seem less keen to take it seriously. As a result, we're now in a situation where religious misogynists are not only tolerated in public life, they are subsidised by public funds because they are preaching for religious charities which pay little or no tax. Take the case of Muhammad Masjid, a mosque in Bradford run by a registered charity. Last year it published a sermon on the YouTube which said a woman who wears makeup beautifies herself and allows everybody else to look at her is destroyed in Islam. The lecturer, Muhammad Huzaifa, said Muslim women who challenge any men dictating how women should dress, speak and act are under the influence of Satan. He even said that women need permission from their husbands to observe voluntary fasts because fasting involves celibacy. In other words, a woman can't say no to sex without her husband's permission. It's clear young men were present at the sermon. They could occasionally be seen on camera. And at the beginning, Huzaifa had asked the youngsters to come closer so they could hear better. That's not counting the youths who may have watched the recording of the sermon at home. Then there's An-Nur Masjid in Birmingham, who offers Quran school for kids, teenagers and adults, and hopes to establish a college in the near future. It published a sermon last year which explicitly said that if a woman repeatedly refuses intercourse, her husband is allowed to hit and shake her. The Charity Commission's response to a complaint about Al-Nur Masjid was to give the charity's trustees advice and guidance and leave it at that. And then there's the Torhead Islamic Education Centre of Maidenhead, which offers weekend instructed in Islamic science studies and caters to all ages from children to 6 years. It hosted a sermon in 2022 which said men should command their daughters to don hijab before they're 15 and women should leave the house without their husband's permission. Speaking about the corruption of modern society, women's liberation, the lecturer said, "We have to raise our daughters not to think like that." So while politicians are getting more anti-misogyny lessons in schools, religious leaders are actively promoting misogyny and encouraging parents to raise their children in these mindsets. Incel ideas are by no means limited to Muslim charities. We found them in Christian ones as well, like the Christadelphian Sunday School Union. A website has a lesson plan intended to be used for children which says a wife is to be subject to a husband and chastises women who wear flamboyant or sexy clothing. The resource suggests the instructor ask young people in the class what women are allowed to do, as they are not allowed to take a leading role or even address the church. It says acceptable suggestions may include make the tea. The lesson plan also promotes female stereotypes which reinforce women's subordination. It says a woman should not be domineering or aggressive and her role should be one of helpful service. There's Hormau Europe, which activities include a weekly youth and children Bible study. Its pastor published a series of blogs saying women wear trousers because of the spirit of whoredom and blaming how women dress for an increase in rape. Then there's the Moray Coast Baptist Church, which runs a nursery, a Sunday school and a kids' Bible club. A 2021 sermon on its website said that the primary function of a woman is to be married, to have children and to tend to household affairs, the cooking, the cleaning, the washing up. He also said he wouldn't want his wife to look sensual around other people. When we reported this charity to the Scottish Charity Regulator, OSCR, it refused to act, telling us the views expressed are likely to be held by virtue of a manifestation of a religious belief. So OSCR is apparently fine with misogyny as long as it's religious misogyny. This is likely the tip of the iceberg. In these cases, the charities chose to put these sermons online and we happened to find them. Far worse may be said behind closed doors of these places of worship. These charities are all registered under the advancement of religion. This charitable purpose exists because there's an outdated assumption that advancing religion is inherently good for people in society. As these examples show, very often it clearly isn't. The National Secular Society has spent years raising these real-life cases with parliamentarians. We're still waiting for the meeting that Adolescence Creators got within weeks of the broadcast. We should welcome the increased discussion on how to ensure boys and young men don't fall prey to incel ideology. But parliamentarians must allow popular culture to distract them from must not allow them to distract them from tackling the underlying issues. These are complex and mean having some difficult conversations, including challenging both religion and charity law. Cracking down on the widespread misogyny of religious charities is not as popular, not as glamorous, and let's face it, not as fun as watching and promoting a Netflix show. But if politicians actually take the incel problem seriously, it's something they need to do urgently. And that's the end of the article. And while it only brushes against the subject of education, it is a serious issue that the UK and Australia, and especially in the United States, religion is sticking its beak right in the face of public education, in fact stealing funds from public education for religious instruction in schools. Now we're going to go to the United States, where I'm going to briefly talk on an article that Diana Ravitch wrote on her blog on the August 28th, 25th. And it is South Carolina, one-third of vouchers awarded to students who remain in public schools. Now, the voucher system is the camel's nose in the tent of getting rid of funding to public education and funneling it towards private education. So I'll just begin the article. This is a new twist on the voucher scam. In South Carolina, a state audit revealed that about one-third of the vouchers awarded by the state went to students who returned to their local public school and never left it. This is an article, actually, that appeared by Zach Kursky of The State. And Zach reported, more than a third of the nearly 3,000 South Carolina students awarded taxpayer-funded school vouchers last year withdrew or were removed from the program due to eligibility concerns, South Carolina Department of Education data shows. The department suspended the accounts of 1,229 voucher recipients last year after they were flagged during enrolment checks conducted to verify that participants had left their zoned school districts and education Department spokesman said. To be eligible for a voucher last year, a student could not be enrolled for a full time in their local district. About one in five of the suspended accounts were reinstated for further review, and that confirmed their eligibility. The remaining 1,000 suspended participants, all of whom had already received the $1,500 scholarship payment, left the program. All the recipients were removed from the program due to enrolment verification and had been enrolled at their zoned public schools. South Carolina Department of Education spokesman Jason Raven wrote in an emailed statement, "The department recovered all unused funds that remained in the scholarship accounts of former participants, but did not attempt to recover any scholarship money whose participants had already spent it. Launched last year, South Carolina's school voucher program publicly subsidises low and middle income families that send their K-12 children to private schools or public schools outside their residence area. Families making no more than twice the federal poverty level, or $62,000, for a family of four were eligible for $6,000 in vouchers last school year." That's the end of the article. But it was just showing that there's rorting going on inside the voucher system already. And this is what the voucher system is, what the Republicans are using to wedge people away from private education and into the hands of the profit-making ventures known as private schools. And there appears to be a large amount of graft and corruption going on, or at the very least, skimming off the top of these voucher programs, which are bleeding money away from schools. And now this article I'm going to is from appeared in The Conversation on the 21st of August 25. The article's by Sydney Shapiro, who's a professor of law at Wake Forest University, and Joseph Termain, professor of law at University of Cincinnati. And the article is, "Why America Still Needs Public Schools." And it begins, "While the White House's fight with elite universities such as Columbia and Harvard has recently dominated the headlines, the feud overshadows the broader and more far-reaching assault on K-12 public education by the Trump administration and many states. The Trump administration has gutted the Department of Education, imperiling efforts to protect student civil rights, and proposed billions in public education cuts for fiscal year 26. Meanwhile, the administration is diverting billions of taxpayer funds into K-12 private schools. These moves build upon similar efforts by conservative states to rein in public education going back decades. But the consequences of withdrawing from public education could be dire for the US. In our 2024 book, How Government Built America, we explore the history of public education from Horace Mann's Common School Movement in the early 19th century to the GI Bill in the 20th. That helped millions of veterans go to college to become homeowners after World War II. We found that the public education had been essential for not only creating an educated workforce, but for inculcating the United States' fundamental values of liberty, equality, fairness, and the common good. In the public good, opponents of public education often refer to public schools as government schools, a pejorative that seems intended to associate public education with big government, seemingly at odds with the small government preference of many Americans. But as we have previously explored, government has always been a significant partner with the private market system in achieving the country's fundamental political values. Public education has been an important part of that partnership. Education is what economists call a public good, which means it not only benefits students, but the country as well. Mann, an education reformer, often dubbed the father of the American public school system, argued that universal publicly funded non-sectarian public schools would help sustain the American political institutions, expand the economy, and fend off social disorder. In researching Mann's Common Schools, another educational history for our book, two lessons stood out to us. One is that US investment in public education over the past 150 years has created a well-educated workforce that has fueled innovation and unparalleled prosperity. As our book documents, for example, in the late 18th and 19th centuries, the states expanded public education to include high school to meet the increasing demand for a more educated citizenry as a result of the Industrial Revolution. And the GI Bill made it possible for returning veterans to earn college degrees or train for vocations, support young families and buy homes, farms or businesses, and it encouraged them to become more engaged citizens, making US democracy more vibrant in the middle of the 20th century. The other equally significant lesson is that the Democratic and Republican principles that propelled Mann's vision of the common school have coloured many Americans' assumptions about public schooling ever since. Mann's goal was a virtuous
Republican citizenry. That is, a citizenry educated in good citizenship, democratic participation and social well-being. Mann believed there was nothing more important than the proper training of the rising generation, calling it the country's highest earthly duty. Attacking public education. Today, Mann's vision and all that has been accomplished by public education is under threat. Trump's second term has supercharged efforts by conservatives over the past 75 years to control what is taught in the public schools and to replace public education with private schools. Most notably, Trump has begun dismantling the Department of Education to devolve more policymaking to the state level. The department is responsible for, among other things, distributing federal funds to public schools, protecting students' civil rights, and supporting high-quality educational research. It's also been responsible for managing over $1 trillion in student loans, a function that the administration is still moving to the Small Business Administration, which has no experience in loan management. The President's March 2025 executive order has slashed the department's staff in half, with especially deep cuts to the Office of Civil Rights, which, is, as noted, protects students from illegal discrimination. Trump's efforts to slash education funding has so far hit roadblocks with the Congress and the public. The administration is aiming to cut education funding by $12 billion for fiscal year 26, which Congress is currently negotiating. Contradicting its stance on ceding more control to states and local communities, the administration has also been mandating what it can't and what must be taught in public schools. For example, it's threatened funding to school districts that recognise transgender identities or teach about structural racism, white privilege, or similar concepts. On the other hand, the White House is pushing the use of patriotic education that depicts the founding of US as unifying, inspiring, and ennobling. Promoting private education. As Trump and states have cut funding and resources to public education, they've been shifting more money to K-12 private schools. Most recently, the budget bill passed by Congress in July 25 gives taxpayers a tax credit for donations to organisations that fund private school scholarships. The credit, which unlike a deduction, counts directly against how much tax someone owes, is $1,700 for individuals and double for married couples. The total cost would run into the billions, since it's unclear how many taxpayers will take advantage. Meanwhile, 33 states direct public money towards private schools by providing vouchers, tax credits, or another form of financial assistance to parents. Altogether, states allocated $8.2 billion to support private school education in 2024. Government funding of private schools diverts money away from public education and makes it more difficult for public schools to provide the quality of education that would most benefit students and the public at large. In Arizona, for example, many public schools are closing their doors permanently as a result of the state's support for charter schools, homeschooling and private school vouchers. That's because public schools are funded based on how many students they have. As more students switch to private schools, there's less money to cover teachers' salaries and fixed costs such as building maintenance. Ultimately, that means fewer resources to educate the students who remain in the public school system. We believe in the harm to the country of promoting private schools while rolling back support for public education is more about dollars and cents. It would mean abandoning the principle of universal non-sectarian education for America's children, and in so doing, man's virtuous citizenry will be much harder to build and maintain. America's private market system, in which individuals are free to contract with each other with minimal government interference, has been important to building prosperity and opportunity in the US, as our book documents. But as we also establish, relying on private markets to educate America's youth makes it harder to create equal opportunity for children and learn and be economically successful, leaving the country less prosperous and more divided. With that, I'll leave it off and head you back to the dog's headquarters. Cheerio, folks, and good luck.
Well, thanks very much, Jeff. But now we come to the best part of our program. We leave the best till last. The Educator, which is a magazine for teachers and educators around Australia, hasn't decided that the best school of the year, believe it or not, is one of the wealthy private schools. In fact, it's a school that's got about 44% of its children from the lowest 25% of the wealth in the country. And it's up there in New South Wales, in Newcastle. Let's hear about it from Andy, shall we?
Thanks, Jane. Inside Australia's School of the Year, and this was published on the 29th of August in The Educator. Friday the 8th of August was a night that Hunter Sports High School principal Rachel Byrne is unlikely to forget any time soon. In addition to being awarded the A-Team Tuition Secondary School of the Year and an Excellence Award in the category of School Principal of the Year Government, Byrne's school became the first to win the national accolade of Wayground, formerly Quizzes, Australian School of the Year for a second year running. The school, located in Gateshead, New South Wales, makes no secret about the key to its success. For years, Hunter Sports High School has carved out a reputation for ensuring student success by seamlessly weaving together academic rigour with authentic real-world learning. Despite being situated in a low socio-economic area with an ICSEA score of 938 and nearly half of its students in the lowest socio-educational advantage quartile, the school has experienced a surge in enrolment, a testament to its growing reputation. Equity, excellence, and innovation at every turn. When asked what she believes are the pillars to a great school, Principal Rachel Byrne pointed to strong foundations that go well beyond academic results. For me, the pillars are excellence in teaching and learning, with a relentless focus on high-quality, evidence-based practice that challenges every student to achieve their personal best, Byrne told The Educator. It's also about innovation and personalisation, ensuring that every student has a pathway that reflects their strengths, passions and future goals. Byrne said the school's academy model has been central to creating personalised real-world learning opportunities. Equity and inclusion are also essential, with a commitment to ensuring that all students, regardless of their background, are seen, valued and supported to succeed, she said. This includes fostering cultural pride, celebrating diversity and closing equity gaps. Byrne added that a great school also places student agency and well-being at its centre, ensuring young people feel a sense of belonging, voice and ownership, while nurturing their social, emotional and physical well-being. Collaboration and partnerships strengthen this foundation, with students, families, staff and the wider community sharing responsibility for learning and success, she said. Great schools are community hubs that connect classrooms with the world beyond school. Byrne said future readiness must underpin all of this. Schools must prepare young people not only for exams, but for life, equipping them with the human capabilities to think critically, adapt and thrive in a complex, fast-changing world shaped by AI and emerging technologies, she said. The ability to collaborate, problem solve and remain resilient in uncertain times is as important as academic success. Because much of this work has not been done before, Byrne said the school is pioneering new approaches to learning, assessment and pathways, while also contributing to the evidence and knowledge that will guide the future of education more broadly. Winning this award 2 years in a row is a recognition of these pillars in action, she said. It reflects the passion of our teachers, the resilience of our students and the strength of a community that believes in the power of public education. Personalised pathways powered by a purpose. At the heart of Hunter Sports High School's academy model is identifying and nurturing the strengths of each student. Because each academy has its own unique purpose and pedagogy, the process for identifying students varies, ensuring the right young people are connected to the pathway that will best help them thrive. For our senior academies, students engage in an application process that often includes parent interviews, information sessions, and shadow days so they can experience the learning style and determine whether it is the right fit. We provide families with information at subject selection evenings and through individual learning support team meetings, ensuring students and parents are well informed before committing to a pathway. Importantly, all senior placements are supported by teacher nominations, academic results, and student commitment, with final decisions made through senior executive interviews and parent approval. For junior academies, identification is strengthened through a robust transition program with our local primary school partners, she said. Close relationships with primary school teachers allow us to build a strong picture of each child's strengths, learning needs, and potential pathways. Byrne said teacher nominations play an important role in this process, helping to recognise students who would benefit from specific academies such as Enrichment, Hunter or T1. Across all academies, the process is collaborative, she said. Parents are central to decision making and student agreement is essential. We believe the academy journey only works when students, families and staff commit to working as one unit to support the young person. Byrne said the goal is a purposeful, student-centred placement grounded in evidence and partnership. By using applications, interviews, teacher input, primary partnerships and parent engagement, we ensure every student is placed in the environment where their strengths can be recognised, nurtured and leveraged for future success. Moving beyond a one-size-fits-all curriculum. Byrne said Hunter Sports High's academy structure has been transformational in reimagining what school can be. Each academy provides a personalised pathway with its own pedagogy, delivery and assessment design tailored to the needs of its students. This model has allowed us to move beyond a one-size-fits-all curriculum and instead create opportunities where every student can thrive, whether that is through portfolio and exhibition assessments, credentialing, elite performance pathways or applied learning. The success of the academies is evident both student outcomes and student voice, said Byrne. We have seen exceptional academic growth, improved well-being, and stronger engagement, with students reporting higher levels of belonging, motivation, and confidence in their learning, she said. Families and industry partners consistently tell us that the academies prepare young people for real-world pathways in ways that traditional models do not. In 2025, the school continued this momentum with the launch of three new academies. The Elite Sports Academy provides Year 11 students with a HSC pathway that integrates a Certificate 3 in sport, athlete, strength and conditioning, and industry-based learning. The NRL Rise Rugby League Academy, currently running as a pilot, combines the ROSA curriculum with a specialised rugby league program, offering holistic development for emerging athletes. The Hunter Connect Academy provides a supportive and responsive environment for students experiencing internalising well-being challenges such as school refusal, withdrawal or anxiety. Byrne said that many of these students demonstrate strong academic ability but require an alternative setting that prioritises well-being, emotional safety and confidence building, while still offering academic extension and flexible individualised support. Helping students find their next step their way. Looking ahead, Byrne says the school community is excited to introduce the Next Step Academy in 2026. This pathway will support students at risk of leaving school without a clear destination who are not yet ready for employment or further study, she said. It will provide a scaffolded Stage 6 program building around hands-on practical learning, content-endorsed courses, and out-learning opportunities. Byrne said the model will maintain the relational advisory-based structure that has been successful in our junior academies while building towards meaningful credentials, future readiness and personal development across years 11 and 12. Together, these academies reflect our ongoing commitment to continuous improvement, equity and future readiness, she said. They not only give students alternative ways to succeed, but also prioritise the development of general capabilities and complex competencies, skills that will be vital in an unpredictable AI-driven world of work. Back to you, Jean.
Well, you wouldn't have to be brilliant to guess what's the great state school of the week. Let's hear from Andy again.
Every week on the Doctor Program, we have a special segment to show a different state school is a great school.
State schools are great schools.
School of the week. State school.
School of the week.
Great state schools.
State schools. School of the week. School for the week here on the Dogs Program.
And this week's great state school of the week is Hunter Sports High, located in Gateshead, a suburb of the city of Lake Macquarie, Greater Newcastle, in New South Wales. Welcome to Hunter Sports High School. Hunter Sports High School is a diverse learning community that aims to ignite curiosity and spark passions in our students, inspiring a love for lifelong learning. Our motto, Personalising Pathways, reflects our commitment to providing individualised support and guidance to each student as they navigate their educational journey. Our mission is to co-create meaningful graduate attributes in an inclusive and empowering environment where every student has the opportunity to thrive and develop essential life skills in a dynamic world. At Hunter Sports High School, we are dedicated to nurturing a community where diverse talents are celebrated and every student is encouraged to reach their full potential. And now some facts and figures from the My School website. Enrollment is 925 and the ICSEO value is well below average at 947, representative of a diverse urban community. Students with parents in the upper 25% of incomes make up 10% of the student enrolment. The second level of parental income, 18% of students. The third 25%, i.e. below 50%, is 28% of students, and 44% of students have parents in the lowest 25% of Australian incomes, with 6% speaking a language other than English and 24% Indigenous students. The finances: recurrent grants from the Australian government of $4.178 million and from the New South Wales government, $14 million. Private fees, etc., add $760,000, and other private contributions add $221,000. And that works at $22,103 per pupil. The capital, $1.75 million over 3 years. And the NAPLAN results are all above average. Back to you, Jean.
Well, congratulations to Hunter Sports High and all of its teachers and students. If you want to find out more about the Dogs, you can go to our website at www.adogs.info. But our time is gone, and I'd like to thank our team, particularly Dale, our producer, and Ambie, her offsider who does so much work for us, and Sorrel, of course, and Jeff. But from all of us here at 3CR and the Dogs program, it's bye for now.
I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe, says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die, says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find your hill. It's there you'll find your hill. I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.